So let's proceed.
Which
ask
is
us anything.
So with respect to your the last talk, you know, there's a lot of essentially primitives for cleanly doing asynchronous multi-threaded paradigm type programming. My question was going to be, because sort of the other side of that coin is message passing, and I was wondering if there's any discussion about including primitives to do more message passing type of design rather than throwing essentially just lambdas around.
So the question is, do we have more message passing styles coming? So yes, and one of the first things you need is a message queue. And as soon as you have that, so going back to the last talk, and those of you watching this now, you'll also see on Channel 9, which will be somewhere near here, and maybe Charles can post a link to it, is the video of the last talk I just gave a few minutes ago. You will see how you can build on that primitive, that message queue, everything else, including we had an example of a concurrent of T, which you can use to build an active object, which is where everything's a message. And I strongly encourage that pattern. Look at that one slide that showed active object, which I teach in effective concurrency also, and I've written articles about. You can find them on the web. Because the technique is make every member function call asynchronous, and now you're in a, those are strongly typed messages, where you're now leveraging what the language already has. Full function signature type safety, type checking, you get conversions, everything, the full rich type system for messages, because function by making function calls be strongly typed messages using that technique. So definitely look there. That is the poster child thing that people should be doing much more of.
What's the situation as regards standard support for message queues and other kinds of either concurrent algorithms, data structures, or lock-free data structures?
So we're currently working on that. In particular, for the blocking style, the key thing is a mutex, and so we've got mutex and several variants now in the standard and lock guards to work with them and the whole machinery. What you want for the non-blocking style, the key primitive is the message queue, which you use along with a thread or async. And that we don't actually have a message queue, a concurrent queue or something in the standard. That is being proposed in this round. And something that I mentioned the other day, too, is that in this round of standardization, not only are we trying to do it in fewer years, but also leave still it be a decent amount of time for the language changes so as to not encourage a lot of churn in the language, but to start shipping libraries in smaller pieces asynchronously along with technical specifications before the rest of the standard. And so as soon as next year, we'll see things like file system, hopefully. And so shortly after that, perhaps things like message queues.
Okay. Cool. Next question.
At lunch, we discussed one of the things we really felt was missing from C++ in general is compared to managed language is unit testing frameworks and the almost built-in language support that some of the managed languages have. Is there any way the standard could support that more succinctly?
You're Mr. Standardization Committee. Sorry. This goes to you.
You're it.
And also Mr. One Product, one of the implementations. So you can do a good job with the standard language as it is. Now, there are some extensions that might make things more helpful. I do not know of any active proposals. I do know that products currently do support unit testing frameworks for C++, so we ship a product like that. Can those be improved? Yes. Where does that fit in the priority of all the good ideas we could standardize? Or as my manager at work is very fond of saying, just for features in the product, and you can apply the same reasoning to the standard, nobody has a bad idea. Well, that's usually true, but let's say nobody has a bad idea. The question is, how many of the good ideas can we do? And which ones are the most important to give the most value to the most people, fill the most urgent holes? That's not an argument against unit testing, just to put it into balance. Also, it requires in standardization someone to come up with a proposal and submit it and defend it and invest time in it. If you're willing to do that, send me mail. Go to std-discussion and std-proposals at isoccpp.org and start that ball rolling because we welcome that kind of input and this is the right time for it.
Great.
Yes, we heard a lot of negatives about standard async from Scott with the default launch policies kind of being ambiguous, and you even mentioned possibly a bug with the features. And yet we do hear you should use it sort of by default to launch your asynchronous work. One of the examples you had was the concurrent queue. You use async a lot. Well, what if that worker thread that's supposed to be doing all the stuff never actually launches? I don't remember seeing a get that would force it to launch. for any of the, or no, there was a Git with the auto, but I mean, the concern, I mean, so what, can someone say why we should use async? Because I heard a lot of like, maybe async has some issues.
I don't want to take over everything.
Let me ask, because he remarked on some stuff that I had said. I don't want you to get the wrong impression that I'm opposed to async or that I think async is bad. Fundamentally, what I said is async is a single interface with two possible implementations. And then I mentioned two or three situations where the difference in behavior can be problematic. But I also listed a slide where I said, if you can live with these restrictions, for example, you're not using thread local storage, if you do not require concurrent execution, and there was a third one I don't remember, then async works really fine for you and you can rely on the default launch policy. The big advantage of async is that it can do thread throttling for you. You basically turn over all the thread management to the underlying implementation, and presumably there's some really smart people using thread pools or using work-stealing runtimes or something like that. And the specification was specifically written to at least permit that and possibly encourage it. So I wouldn't want you to walk away with the impression that I think async is bad. I do think that there are some conditions where it is not suitable to use the default launch policy. But for example, if I were going to be sitting down and writing asynchronous code, that's the first tool I would reach for would be async. I would think carefully about whether I can live with the restrictions that I mentioned. But I don't think it's a bad interface. I just think it's an interface that is a little bit more complicated than people initially think.
So with the example I used, notice I did use a std thread in the example I think you're referring to, so that in the concurrent of T implementation, so it will be asynchronous. Although now that you mention it, that was mostly out of pedagogical habit because I teach that same thing for other platforms and other languages than C++, and of course they only know about thread. But now that you mention it, I wouldn't mind switching that to std async launch async. So std async is great, in my opinion. The whole future destructor blocks thing is arguably wrong, and we're revisiting that. So we're going to see if we'll fix that detail. But the default launch policy is exactly what you want it to be. And so if you don't like it, blame me, because I'm probably the one who led the charge and lobbied for multiple years to make sure that the default launch policy was launch on this or another thread, specifically so we could implement it on a work-stealing runtime efficiently, and to throttle threads and do that kind of thing, which in fact we're doing in this release of Visual C++. We implement std async on top of the concert runtime, which does all that groovy stuff for you. The only time you need to override the default launch policy is if you're specifically in the case where you want to get work off this thread, in which case just stick in launch async.
Well, that's not the only case.
Yes, there's also launch deferred, but that's only for debugging, and it's of questionable usefulness, and you should never use it in regular code. So launch deferred doesn't really exist, so it's not part of our regular programming package. It's either with a default launch policy, or if you really want to get work off this thread, that's the primary reason to use launch async.
Great, next question.
Hi. I have a question about the modules proposal, and that I believe was submitted at some stage. And I would like to ask, is anyone doing any work on modules? And if they are you guys thinking about templates in the context of modules? And that, to me, sounds very difficult, and I cannot imagine a way forward. But is it actually possible? Is it implementable?
Short answer, modules are being worked on. At the last meeting in February, I created a specific study group for modules, and appointed Doug Greger as the chair, Doug Greger of Apple, and also David van der Voorde of Edison Design Group, are the two hench people most interested in working on this. Doug's got some excellent ideas, and in fact, templates is the one thing that he didn't have a complete answer for in February and is actively working on. So he's the one, by the way, who did modules for Objective-C. So he knows a little bit about this problem and knows quite a bit about C++. So he's a great guy to have working on this. Those of you who don't know Doug Greger, he was the author of one of the concepts proposals. He's currently the final check-in authority on Clang. He's a good guy to have working on this. And I'm looking forward to seeing what he comes up with in a couple of months.
Great.
I've got a question about keywords. If they look at for each or look at the uniform initialization syntax, in these two cases, you've taken either a keyword or a syntactic construct and you've tied it specifically to a class or an expected interface, which is different than, say, C++98. And I'm wondering if this is a trend that we're going to see continue, where keywords or new syntactic constructs are tied specifically to interfaces from STID, which as a library author, maybe I want to have a different thing than standard initializer list that the uniform initializer works with. Is the committee going to continue down this path, or are we done, or what's the feeling on that?
Wait, we're talking about for each, are you talking about for each the algorithm, or are you talking about range-based force? Okay, because the thing about range-based force is, as far as they're not tied to any specific thing, and in fact, there's a specification of what things can be iterated over using a range-based for. They don't have to be part of the standard namespace. They don't have to use the standard namespace at all, because it uses argument-dependent lookup to find begin and end for those kinds of things. So I would argue that's not tied to anything specifically in standard, and a library writer should be able to hook into that framework without any trouble at all.
That's not, but the,
it certainly, it
yeah, begin and end, but that's not standard. It's just two words. But std initializer list does fit that mold much better. So essentially, we have a syntactic rewrite from the curly brace syntax into, imagine a smart macro, if you wish, into a call to std initializer list that's inserted there and makes it on the callee side. I'm not sure what the intent is here, but it is my personal opinion that, and also coming from experience mostly, that syntactic rewrites, when done in taste, are very good and very useful and keep the core language small.
I mean, the thing about initializer lists is it's basically just a special kind of container that permits you to iterate over the contents of something for of a particular type. So I mean, they needed to give it a type of some kind.
Right, it's tied to the standard because we have a syntactic construct in the core language that actually rewrites into something in the standard. And you know, if things were to be like very rigorously defined, I would say there should be some sort of core language support kind of namespace in which all of these entities that you know essentially allow C++ programs to even exist, should be because we have, it's not std initializer list, it's sort of, you know, core language support :: initializer list, or you know, the same goes about type info, type ID, and you know, a lot of other such things.
Great.
I would like to refer to yesterday's panel about the convincing our colleagues to start using C++11. We have something like 10 or more years of discussions about the exceptions, if they are right or not, and old C++, you could nearly get away without them because it didn't throw much. But it seems that it changed much with new standard library in C++11 because it throws a lot, like the threading library and other stuff. So I found that many of my colleagues are afraid of those exceptions, and this is why they don't want to join C++ in 11 in their code. Moreover, some coding standards like Google Code or LLVM do not allow you using them. So what is your opinion on that? Are they really that scary and we should not use them?
Got as expected T.
Unless you expected coffee. But in particular, you emailed me that question. I forwarded it to people at Google and to Bjarne and to people at LVM to get their opinion. So Doug Gregor again and Chandler at Google. And the short consensus so far in this already lengthy email thread is that what's appropriate for Clang LLVM for deep tools is not representative of all code. So there is a tendency to say, let's take the coding standard for a compiler and apply it to all code. That's not necessarily a good idea.
Yeah, but what about Google then? I mean, you know, they do good things.
Yeah. So in particular, in this case, there are reasons why Clang and LLVM do the things that they do that aren't generally applicable to a lot of other code. Second, Google has struggled with whether to stay with without exceptions or not. And the issue has nothing to do with C++11 adding more stuff that may throw. It's with a lot of things to do with training, with culture, with understanding how to deal with it. And unfortunately, it's true that some people will look at that and say, oh, that must be the right way to do it. But that's the current state of things. Well, the one thing that's interesting is originally one of the reasons may have been for performance reasons. Those reasons have largely been accepted to have gone away. Yet sometimes the myth persists, but those reasons have largely gone away. And that's something very 20th century.
And sometimes the performance loss persists, but you know, I'm just saying. may I put a skunk on the table here real quick? All right, so so we have a few additions related to exceptions in C++11, such as exception PTR, right? Current exception, rethrow exception, which is, you know, works with exception PTR. And all of these are, in my opinion, imperfect patches to some design mistakes that were made back when the exception hierarchy was defined. So there are a few issues that are really persistent in C++ with regard to exception handling. The first one probably is that you can throw anything. And that really makes it next to impossible to do anything structured and meaningful with any exception, because you don't have this notion of any exception. It's really the bottom type. So it doesn't make much sense to, you know, I want to get my hands on the current exception and mess with it. You know, all of this exception PTR paraphernalia, I think, is actually a standing witness of how poor the decisions were made back in the 80s. You know, so there's no fault assigned here, because it was a long time ago. All of that stuff was much more novel. But essentially what exception should have had, they should have had virtual methods for cloning and for rethrowing, which would have solved a lot of issues. And also, you know, throw should have been allowed to only throw polymorphic objects of a specific base. So with these two, so exception must be clonable. They must have virtual functions that, you know, rethrow the same exact type, and with a mechanism for refusing to throw anything but a specific class hierarchy. These three decisions would have made for a much more compelling case for people to, you know, you get to use this, and you know, because it has all of these advantages. Unfortunately, and you know, there's also like the old stuff that has remained just as bad, such as unquote exception is just as useless as it once was, so no progress there. And Herb and I were just discussing, we'll be looking into ways to define additional library functions to make that useful. But you know, all told, the story about exception handling in C++ is, unfortunately, not as brilliant and as bright and as pleasant as we would like it to be. So, you know, I think it's, you know, you would still have an uphill fight to convince your team to use exceptions, because there are advantages to them that are clear and, you know, understood for the most part. But there's also drawbacks and unnecessary complications regarding handling them. So I don't think we're looking at a solved problem here.
I want to say that I think you're sort of sidestepping one of the issues here, because the fundamental thing about exceptions is programs do have exceptional conditions. And the challenge of it is, okay, I need to identify the exceptional condition and then somehow get to a point in the code where I can handle the exceptional condition and do something about it. And exceptions may be imperfect, but nevertheless they are a mechanism. You have to sort of say to yourself, well, okay, if we don't use exceptions and I need to convey to some other part of the program something unpleasant has occurred, we need to recover and go on, how am I going to do that? Well, what they do in C is they use something like a global like ERNO, and then they have to check that every place. Or they use status values and they return those all the way down the chain. And we know that those don't work very well. C programmers will tell you that they don't work very well. They don't scale very nicely, and they actually generate really lousy code too. You've got conditionals all over the place if you rigorously check these things everywhere. So exceptions may not be a perfect solution, but I think that for the kinds of applications where when an exceptional condition arises and you need to be able to return to some place in the program with valid data structures intact and continue running, exceptions make up a pretty compelling case compared to the alternatives.
Right, but you know, I'm also thinking sort of at a broader level, you know, how about the competition, languages that do support exceptions in arguably more, you know, convenient ways, such as C#, Java, or even Python. So all of these languages have learned a lot of lessons since C++ came about, and they have a much more structured way of dealing with exceptions. And in those languages, it's much easier to create a compelling case. You know, it's better to use exceptions.
So I'm going to push back on that, because I don't actually agree that there is a fundamental. There are differences, there are improvements, but they're incremental, they're not fundamental. Because yes, those languages in particular, for example, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you what the advantages are. One I know is a monolithic hierarchy based on exception has some advantages, so you talked about that. That's convenient, but not necessary. And what other features do they have? So multiple exceptions, some of them have chosen to have multiple exceptions at the same time. But the thing that you said about having an exception with a virtual method clone and rethrow versus having a helper, it's not that big a difference.
As exception PTI is not the helper, it's an opaque type.
It works really well. It's pretty convenient. I saw you using it on the slides, and it was just a line of code.
It doesn't work very well. My slides are just awesome because, you know, it's just that's not the reason, okay? So, you know, there's a lot of inconvenience and, now seriously, there's a lot that could be done a lot better about expected and its ilk if exception PTR weren't such a not so good job.
But going to Scott's point too, I think one of the key things, so certainly exceptions, which are basically roughly materially the same in, say, C# and Java. There are a few differences, but they're largely kind of operationally the same. And the reasons why people don't use them in C++ apply equally, pretty much, to the reasons in Java.
I would disagree,
It's writing the exception safe code and so forth.
I just disagree on that. Sorry.
Having said that,
interrupt us.
Hard to interrupt destruction.
Having said that, I'm going to stop talking after agreeing with Scott. That
excellent stopping point.
That error, that really much of the discussion about exceptions versus not exceptions misses the point, that it's exceptions aren't hard, error handling is hard. And by far the most common mistake people make, and have been making for 20 years, and I'm frankly surprised they still do it, but it's still common, is to compare correct exception handling code with code that does very little or no error handling. Not a fair comparison, but an extremely common one.
Excellent.
So after missing the C++ 11 standards, what's the future for concepts?
Concepts are being worked on. If we get static if in the language, we might get a concepts light in the next standard. Otherwise, we're likely not to have concepts. But people are working on it. And perhaps it will bear fruit. It's investigation.
Good job, Charles. Yeah.
What about H results, man?
I'm not so familiar with threads where I saw boost threads. I like the idea that you can interrupt a thread, and then when I go to standard thread, it's not possible. And I'm not familiar with why not. Why did that not make it?
You mean kill a thread?
No, interrupt.
Interrupt like suspend?
So the short answer is that see my article, Interrupt Politely, and which you can Google for, and it'll be there. And in particular, it turns out that it was not supported purely for political reasons because it was controversial, so to get threads in the standard to remove the controversial part. And now I'm glad we didn't, because I think the right way to do it is always and only cooperative cancellation. Kill you should just never ever use. You cannot use it correctly. You cannot write correct code using kill. And interrupt is almost as bad. And the right way to do it is something is either by setting your own flags and having an ad hoc protocol, and everybody cooperates because you can see it in your code, or use a cancellation token, such as, for instance, .NET uses. That's actually a very good idea. And then you can pass a token around, and it's through that sort of a formalization of the cooperative ask to cancel, check if somebody's asked you to cancel.
Yeah, but there's no support for cancellation tokens right now, right? There should be, right? It should be supported in the standard natively. And the whole issue of cooperative termination of threads, there should be some support for it.
Well, there are proposals right now. In fact, we're proposing the cancellation token as part of the...
I think that's a great idea. Yeah.
What does Facebook use?
We have our own specialists who have their own... But quite to be honest, we write services to run like forever. And people don't care that much about stopping. It's like, if you don't stop, you just kill the thing and restart, and that's about it.
Excellent.
It's a question for Scott Myers. Yesterday you mentioned that you can give some recommendation about using aftercare word, autocare word.
I'm sorry, about using what?
Auto.
Oh, about using auto.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. There are some people who argue that you should just use auto all the time, which is great advice if it were practical.
Almost all the time.
There are some initialization expressions which return a type other than what you expect them to be. It tends to arise in template metaprogramming, where you may get a proxy for some other type,
initializer list.
Well, initializer list is just a weird case. The problem is this. Let me put it this way. Herb has given some advice in some earlier talks where he said, you just want to use auto because it's the natural, reasonable thing to do. It does exactly what you want. And I'm with him so far. And then he goes, except in the following conditions. And then he talks about, okay, under some conditions, for example, if you're doing some kind of a metaprogramming thing, you will get back some intermediate type, which represents an intermediate value that you don't know anything about, which normally would have decayed into the type that you thought that you were getting. The problem is, what that means is, as a user, I have to understand that although I'm conceptually calling a function to get back something of type X, because that's what I think I'm going to get, I'm really getting something of type Y, which frankly is an implementation detail. But I have to know that implementation detail because I have to know that in that case, I can't use auto. So I would love to be able to give the advice, just use auto and don't even think about it. The problem is, you can't use auto and not be fairly familiar with exactly what is coming back. So to make my position, I hope, a little bit clearer, I like auto. I use it all the time. I think it's great. But I think that blanket advice of just use auto and don't worry about it is eventually going to lead to really surprising compiler errors with error messages referring to types that people have absolutely no idea about whatsoever.
Or runtime errors, for that matter.
It could be runtime errors.
Or efficiency loss. Did you see much auto in my talks on optimization? I use UINT32 and take the difference between two pointers. It would have otherwise been, you know, a 64-bit integer, and the performance would decrease by, you know, 5,000 billion times, you know?
Approximately.
Approximately.
Now, his slides are awesome. Now, just ask him.
Now, in fairness, and I know you know this, but let me state more clearly what my position actually is, which is you should use auto all the time.
Period.
Except
what
only
does that mean? All the time, except.
You should use auto all the time except for one case, not a list of them, just one case, and that is when you want a type conversion. One of the reasons you might want a type conversion is to convert to a different type, to decay to a known type. So the cases you're talking about are expression templates. When expression templates give you some sort of intermediate type, that's covered under I want a type conversion.
But you have to know that you want a type conversion.
I know. I didn't say that you didn't have to know it. You have to know it. When you want a type conversion, that's when you shouldn't use auto. Otherwise, you should use auto. Now, some of the reasons, we talked about the sharp edges. That's fine. Let's also give some of the reasons why to use auto. It's shorter. It's more convenient. It's more future-proof because if you change your function's return type, your auto variable is just correct. And I actually find it amazing that not just in C++ 11, but also in C sharp and other languages that have that, like var and let, so that kind of type deduction, that there are ongoing discussions that seem to never end, and therefore I doubt they'll end in C++, since they haven't ended in the other languages, about whether this makes your code harder to read or not. It really doesn't. At least that's my strong opinion. And not just if you're in an IDE. It's, you know what the type of something is, the compiler does too, and it's tedious to have to say it again. And it's also not as future-proof in case that type changes to something else that's compatible but a different type so that you have to spell it differently. So I'd certainly encourage you to use auto by default unless you need a type conversion to an explicit type you want to deal with.
No destruction?
We'll go on to the next question.
They destroyed already.
Okay, just I want to say one special thing about auto also. We were discussing with some other people here on Monday of one particular case in which auto might be counterintuitive and talking about a future use of the same code. If you have a function that returns a bool and then for some reason you need to add a third case in the in that to the return of that function, you will change that to an enum. You need to treat probably different an enum that you do with a bool. So you'll have to manually check all the call places which this function has that are using auto, because if not, they're going to break. So in that particular case, auto might hide a lot of problems from you.
I think that's a great point. And it, the generalization of it, because I love generalizing, is type mentions, you know, not using type deduction, and not writing auto, writing the type explicitly, what is it? Redundancy, right? It's redundant. I'm redundantly specifying a type, even though it's clear to everybody what the type is, and, you know, I might as well just deduce it. And this was the traditional approach since the, you know, the Pascal days, and even, you know, in Fortran and whatnot. So the types of everything were mentioned first redundantly, and then there's computation going on. And then we have this notion of type deduction and everything, and all of a sudden we have, you know, redundancy. We all know redundancy is bad tradition. Like, we want as little redundancy as possible. We want unique point of maintenance, right? There's an acronym for it. What is it? There's an acronym for unique point of maintenance. I guess UPM, you know? So do it once. So once and only once, right? OOAO, right? Once and only once. So there's a lot going about that. It's a good thing, right? It's a good thing. But then redundancy is also good for double-checking things. And here's where your point comes into play beautifully, because sometimes redundancy actually detects, you know, is checks and balances between callee and caller, and it can actually reveal trouble and you know and problems. That being said, let me add this. So changing a function from bool to int or trul or you know an enum or what have you is an interface change. And there are ways in which you can change a function that even with the redundant time mention, it could break line code. So I don't think it's a frequent case enough and a new thing enough to completely counter the benefits of auto, which is you do have less redundancy and more elasticity to the code, in the sense that the code that uses auto often is easily to maintain by changing a few root types, and then everything gets deduced appropriately. So it's a good point. It's a clear example of the benefits of redundancy and the disadvantages of not having it. And that being said, auto still has a lot of things going for it.
I want to mention too, it's unexpected. This has to do with functions changing types, but in a funny kind of way. There was a report that was put out by a company that actually does static analysis tools. They were looking particularly for problems porting code from 32-bit code bases to 64-bit code bases. And the return type of certain, the return type for the container's size goes from 32 to 64 bits. And a lot of people are in the habit of saying, okay, I'm going to ask for the size of a container, and they sort it into size T. And that doesn't always go to 64 bits on certain 64-bit platforms. Now, technically what you're supposed to refer to is container colon colon size type, which I don't know anybody who types containers colon colon size type. And what they pointed out was, if you say auto size equals whatever, then when you go from the 32-bit platform to the 64-bit platform, you automatically start getting a 64-bit value without rewriting your code at all. Whereas if you'd said size T on certain platforms where that turns out to be a 32-bit quantity, and then you port to the 64-bit code, the code continues to compile because of these implicit conversions between types, but now you have type unsafe code and you can get overflow. So I think the story for auto is a little bit more nuanced than a lot of people recognize at the outset.
Having said that, I am shocked beyond words to hear of a platform that changes pointer size without changing size T. That's nonconforming.
I think he mentioned he didn't mean that that way. Did you mean that when you switch from 32 to 64, you're going to automatically switch the sizes from 32 to 64 if you use auto, right?
What I know the report said was that there was a common return type people stored things in, mm-hmm. and it might have been int, it might have been long, I don't remember what it was.
So if you write int, it's
exactly,
bad.
Exactly. They used the type. I thought it was size T, maybe it was long, I don't remember. Yeah.
And that would be a common thing, because people like to keep those the same. But then using auto saves you because it will automatically
That is the idea.
Excellent.
Yes, a quick two-parter about Herb's assertion about const now meaning thread safe. The first part is, do the other panel members agree with the new connotation of that? And secondly, does that mean that if I write, say, a naive shared pointer where I just use a plain old pointer to an int, does that mean that I'm violating now an invariant because I can't be const because I'm not thread safe?
I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
The second part is, if I'm not using an atomic for my reference counting, if I just use a plain old data type, a pointer to a shared int, that means I couldn't be thread safe. So if I have a const, if somebody tries to use a const of my class, my shared pointer, I couldn't be thread safe because my int wouldn't be synchronized. So I guess what I'm asking is, if const is supposed to be thread safe, does that mean I couldn't, quote, be const? Because I can't be thread safe?
I don't understand that second part of the question.
Yeah, I think I'm framing it badly.
But do you guys agree about const and mutable, meaning thread safe is the first part of the question, and you've had 48 hours to absorb it.
You're first.
Oh, goody. So, what I will say is I think that Herb has a really interesting insight that we used to think that const meant conceptually const, and that doesn't apply in a multi-threaded environment because it used to mean we could mess around with the internal bits, but now it really does have to be bitwise const in order for things to be thread safe. And that is a fundamental shift in what we've been teaching people and our understanding of const.
Or internally synchronized.
Or internally synchronized, right, exactly. So I certainly agree with that. I haven't had a chance to really process the rest of the argument to see, you know, to extended to its logical conclusion, but certainly what we've told people in the past, that const means conceptually const, and it doesn't matter what happens to the bits, that's definitely not true any longer from a thread safety point of view, and as Herb pointed out, the standard actually says const things are thread safe, so we're going to have to adjust our understanding of those terms. That much I certainly agree with.
So, I was very happy about Herb's let's say proposition, if you wish. This new approach in which we associate this type qualifier with safety, with thread safety, because I've been preaching in the desert and there's no water there for years about such things. I mean, some of you may remember my use of volatile as a type qualifier to actually carry this information, this bit, it's locked or not, and it's extremely similar to what Herb does, except it was the exact other way around. No, you use the qualifier as a discriminator, essentially.
Yeah.
And then when we designed D, we made a very strong decision to use immutability as a guarantee for both the user and the compiler that actually this data is immutable. And therefore, it is shareable without locking. And subsequently, there are refinements that suggest that this is a good approach to actually associate the notion of immutability and const, which is maybe immutable, maybe not, with thread safety. So these are very good directions. What I'm afraid of, however, is tension. All right. What I'm afraid, however, of is that Herb is pushing more convention. So, const has been a great tool as a mix of rigor and convention. Agreed? It's not a rigor. It's not putting const there. It does not guarantee a lot. And especially if you do modular, development, it's as soon as you transgress into an opaque module, you don't know what's going on there. So const has always been a combination of I'm going to use some guarantees, and then if I transgress, I get into undefined behavior. But even if I don't get into undefined behavior, if I don't know the history of the object, did it originate as a constant object or not, then I'm not sure whether const represents original immutable object or immutable object. So that's the story with const as of before Herb's talk, like as of yesterday morning, okay? And now we have Herb coming with the notion that, hey, you know what, const is going to be thread safe, and whatever is mutable in there is going to support the threading. It's going to be synchronized, either mutexes, atomics, whatnot, nuclears, hydrogen bomb, you know. So he's going to have this convention, and here's my worry. He's pushing convention into a very frail domain, multi-threaded programming. He's pushing convention into something that is very difficult to get right, and proof by convention is not the most robust way of addressing things. That being said, so this is I'm worried. He's essentially saying, you know what? Let's use this convention from now on. It's not a guarantee.
For what it's true, you have to get it right. For what it's worth, I'm not just making it up. The standard now requires that basically every copyable type has thread safe copy assignment because you could put it in a pair.
Right.
Copy construction because you could put it in a pair.
Right.
And several other examples. So the standard library already says that every type it has and any operation on any type you give to use with the standard library must have const equals thread safe. It requires it, and if you don't do that, you do get undefined behavior. That's true. But it's the direction that
right.
is actually required in C++.
Yeah, but I think the larger question is, for example, std vector map, like a highly non-trivial type. If you call a const method against them, is there a guarantee that's not going to change the bits?
Yes. Actually,
all right.
No. I thought you were going to say thread safe.
Uh-huh.
I thought you were going to say thread safe, and thread safe, that's one of two parts of thread safe. It is guaranteed that it will not cause erase. You are guaranteed to be able to, without synchronization, to use const methods on a
right.
map or a vector of or arbitrary
right.
complexity on two threads, and as long as they're const operations, not have erase, which means bitwise const or internally synchronized. So yes, the standard does require that, and if your vendor doesn't, file a bug report because they don't conform.
Remember my part with the dessert preaching and all that stuff? All right, here's the thing. If you look in github.com Facebook folly, you're going to see a library we designed that relies on this assumption, actually that predates the standard enactment, enactment of the law. So we actually assumed in our library, we have a synchronized macro and we have a way to pair objects with mutexes and stuff like that, and can actually wrap a mutex around a vector and use it. And actually the whole mechanism relies on this very idea that whenever you call a const method against such a locked object, it's guaranteed that you can call it concurrently without any problem. So I'm very happy this is actually now the URA. I'm super happy.
Thank you for preaching in the desert. I know those hair coats are really itchy.
Yeah, you know those hair coats, yeah. So I guess
right.
we're good
next for
the next question.
This is just to jump back to the use of auto, and I guess this kind of ties into convincing your colleagues, and I guess to some extent maybe convincing me too. And so I've had this discussion with a few different people here kind of about the idea of how much we should give preference to, say, always using auto. And one concern that I've had and that some other people that I've talked to at my company have had has been what sort of impact would that have on how quickly someone can understand what the code is doing and potentially how quickly they could debug an issue. And so, I mean, there's no question that if someone's calling, say, a begin function or some function from the standard library, that they would probably know what the return type is. But in a very large code base where there's, potentially hundreds or thousands of function calls that could return very similar types, with auto, and at least in our case, IntelliSense typically doesn't work very well. And so it seems like having to choose between a developer being immediately able to determine what the return type is versus having to do a find in files, having to search some of the other code that we're using to find that return type. I guess, kind of what are your thoughts on, is that really a concern? How much of a concern is it? Or kind of what tools or approaches can we use to help just get around this issue of how this impacts just the time on the developer to do all this digging to figure out what the type is?
Okay.
Why don't you start from your side?
I'm sorry you're going to hear me again. So. I think this is a valid concern. And again, it's a matter of redundancy and when it's good. And in that case, regular interfaces and redundant adornments on the client side do help. That being said, it's a matter of losing some control for the sake of other benefits. And this is not the first time that's happening. remember when operator overloading came into play and iterators had operator overloading and all that stuff, and the very common concern was, you know, looking at this code, I'm not sure what's going to happen. I look at the code, it does star I, it does plus plus I, it does, you know, comparison. I don't even know whether the comparison is going to be a function call or not. So it was a loss of control. Was it good? Arguably, yes, because it raised the level of discourse to a whole new level. It was all about iterators instead of pointers and all of those good things. So we have this notion that's recurrent. You lose some control, but you gain in a different dimension. So we lost with, you know, operator overloading, lost for the sake of better abstraction, let's say. Then we have even, you know, the talk today, this morning. So I talked about this thing that CPU vendors aim for average fast execution time, but they don't aim for control and reproducibility, right? You can't have large variations for any given run as long as, on average, the whole thing marches real fast. So it's again a notion of loss of control. And I remember as a student playing with assembler code, it was for me a very difficult issue to get to terms from Zilog Z80, which had very clear performance profile for every single machine code instruction, to Intel 8080, which had already like a couple of variations out. And then don't mention like zero, you know, non-zero weight state memory. The notion that you had to wait on a variable number of cycles for a memory access, and then cache hierarchy. So it was a whole thing of loss of control. And you could argue that makes anyone used to the old way very uncomfortable. Similarly, and let me finally sort of tie this up, similarly, a lot of people first working with Otto have this sense of losing control. Right, so it's like, oh my God, I'm not sure what type is this one. You know, I'm not sure what's going on. It turns out that the loss of control has benefits associated with it that have been discussed time and again, and the loss of control itself does not manifest so harshly most of the time. So this is something, a message you may take.
Yeah, we had a panel yesterday on convince your colleagues. So let me try to use one of Scott's own arguments and see if it works on him and on you. Because one of the things we haven't said yet about Otto, and this is, I realize now, as I say, this is at the root of the gotcha that you mentioned. However, let me phrase the positive side of it. Remember we said convince your colleagues, especially us C++ programmers, we love efficiency. This is the big red button you push. Otto is fast. It's efficient because it's guaranteed not to give you a conversion. If you say a type, you may say a different type and get a conversion. So try the convincing of, push the efficiency button. Otto is guaranteed to be fast. Does that work?
I find it some compelling in more cases. For example, however, if you have a function which is returning a closure, Otto is vastly more efficient than storing in a standard function pointer. I think, for example, for storing closures, Otto is your friend. It's much more efficient. So I mean, I totally buy that. I think the other things I think the other efficiency arguments are a little bit less compelling. What I want to say to you, however, is I think it's really important to recognize it is not an all or nothing world. Mm-hmm. Otto is a tool.
Yeah.
You can use it where it makes your code more readable, and you can ignore it if you think it's better to not use it. So what I think you should do is start using Otto in the places where it's blatantly obvious what the types are. So when you call begin, when you call end, frankly, I use it whenever I call async because I'm too lazy to type the type of the future. I think when you start using range-based for loops, you will very quickly decide you want to use Otto for virtually everything, because that's the equivalent of calling begin and end. And I think that as you start using Otto in these really obvious cases where you'll say, look, I'm not really giving up very much because I know what the types are anyway, that will make you feel more comfortable with it. And then you can say, okay, now I know that I'm getting something back from this function, and I know I'm going to end up using it in this other function call here. At this point, what you're really saying is, I no longer care so much about exactly what the type is. What I care about is how can I use it. Now you're doing what is, in effect, interface-based programming.
Awesome.
I don't really care exactly what the type is. I care what can I do with it. Yeah. My experience has been that you have to get comfortable with that in the same way that people had to get really comfortable with virtual functions. Remember virtual functions? My
yes.
God, I have no idea what function I'm calling.
Yes.
Remember templates?
I should have
my
mentioned
God,
that.
I
yeah.
have no idea what function I'm calling.
Right.
So Otto is just about, my God, I have no idea what type I have. But I do know what it behaves like. I know how I can treat it. And so maybe there's like a 12-step program to fully embrace an auto. And I think that there will be cases where there's something tricky going on. You're going to say, actually, I do want to be explicit about what the type is here, and that's fine too. So my advice to convincing you, and you're nodding your head, which perhaps is just politeness, but also, no, it's usually one big nod for sleepiness. So I know the sleepiness nod.
I've been doing it for 3 days.
Not just you. But so try this sort of incremental approach. And at some point, you might say, you know, I'm not really comfortable doing that. That's OK. You don't have to use auto under those conditions. It's just the tool. It's there to help you make your code more readable and to make you more productive.
Great. I'm extremely inspired by these questions about auto because I'm very new to C++ 11. And so I may be asking a question that folks who have used it already know the answer to, which is, can't the compiler tell you? Isn't there a little switch that says, here's the deduction I'm doing on the type, and you throw that and it spits out something and you know what it's doing? If that's not there, then why not?
You mean you'd like a compiler switch that prints out the type that got deduced for each use of auto or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, one thing that should be acknowledged is that compiler switches and diagnostics can explode real bad and real fast. And I don't think it's a, I don't think proposing it, I mean, did you ever try man GCC or G++, man G++, did anyone try, right? Or yes, or you just opened MSDN for a Microsoft, you know, a Visual C compiler. It has literally, you know, dozens of flags. And probably hundreds.
I think it's hundreds for GCC.
Probably it's hundreds. I could say confidently it's over 100 at least.
Yeah.
And also, whenever anything odd happens, it's going to spit like warnings and notes and remarks. I've seen this recently at you. So essentially, the root of asking for more messages during compilation, I don't think it's going to make you very popular. You know? I don't think it should be a choice. It's just intellectual overhead for anyone who's reading the documentation.
Having said that, I think you could do it yourself if you really wanted to. You wouldn't just type auto. You could write a macro, of all things, capital A-U-T-O, that you can figure out how to write the two lines or so, that just uses decal type and spits it out as a message using your compiler's messaging feature, if you should like that, and then just use that macro everywhere. Perhaps you could make the feature yourself. Decal type will tell you what it got.
Actually, this reminds me of something I was going to mention before. Didn't you say you wrote a macro for Facebook that was called auto in capital letters?
Yeah.
And it became so wildly popular that that was what convinced some people.
That was part of what tipped the balance.
We need to go to C++ 11 with auto.
Yeah, so the story is we started with macro auto.
This actually relates to convincing your colleagues.
Yeah. We started with a macro called auto in the GCC that did not support it. And it used the type of, which was implemented in GCC at the time. And people started using it, and everybody started hating it at the same time. And it was such a bizarre love-hate relation that the cognitive dissonance at some point gave way. And we assigned a team to actually build a framework to allow us to port our code seamlessly to future versions. And we're actually porting to 4.7 right now. It's been a matter of a couple of weeks for millions of lines of code. I'm very proud of what that team has accomplished. So, and that, you know, it didn't, that all started because of this, but this was one of the terms, you know, we can't live with this, but it's too useful. So convince your colleagues.
All right. Just a follow on for the last question. This is not my idea, it's Tim's idea. Quite often when I'm having to code review other people's code or trying to debug it, I quite often want to print it out. Auto is just going to be a nightmare. So if you can actually say, when I print it out, I want to go and say, well, that's a double, or that's whatever, that would be very advantageous. That's it.
Print. Okay. What I will say, here's a homework project for you. I don't know of any tool that will sort of de-autoize code, which is sort of what you're requesting. This would be an excellent plugin for GCC if you wanted to mess with GCC, or it would be an excellent tool to write on top of Clang. Both of which now give you a way to get into the compiler, and so if you wanted to sort of be able to write a tool that would take code with auto and maybe annotate it with comments or do something like for printout purposes, I have no idea how difficult it would be to write this, but my suspicion, my wild speculation, is that it shouldn't be terribly difficult because the compiler knows statically what all those types are. So it should be, the information is clearly there. How difficult it would be to write a tool to do it, I don't know. I wouldn't expect a compiler to do it. But if you want to learn C++ 11 and also learn how to write compilers, this would be a great project.
Excellent.
I'm totally sold on auto, but there is just one particular situation where we should never use auto. And I think it's obvious for maybe everybody in this room, but maybe not for everybody coming to C++ 11, which is when you do a dynamic memory allocation and you want to take the result, the pointer, and you want to put in a smart pointer, then you have to be explicit and not use auto.
No. Please.
We don't have make unique. We don't have make unique.
I know. Remember when we were all in high school doing that? Never mind. So absolutely, you don't want to write auto p equals new something, right? But in C++ 11, the rule is very close to...
Make sure.
The rule is don't write delete ever again, except unless you, as an exceptional case. And we're very, very close. We're only a make unique away from don't write new ever again. As Scott mentioned in his talk, we should be teaching people to often reach for make shared. And you want to write auto there, because why would you want to write shared putter of widget in front of that, since you already said make shared widget? So actually, you do want auto in the C++ 11 preferred allocation. And yeah, again, make shared pointer. If we had make unique, it would be perfect. But because shared pointer does incur overhead that you shouldn't reach for unless you need it. But we're getting close to having your example actually be a poster child for auto.
So what was the story with no make unique?
And that's it was an oversight. We're going to add it.
A big one.
Well, Mr. Hotshot, want to help write the proposal?
I'll say my poker one face.
We should take only because it's 5 o'clock and some people may have planes to catch.
Okay, because he's rethought his.
Somebody who hasn't asked a question.
And I've been. Okay.
Somebody who did not ask a question so far. We have our man.
Wait for the microphone.
I'm just wondering, in Herb's talk, you have this section of missing. I know maybe Microsoft has the concurrent library, but I'm just wondering on other platforms. What should I use, like concurrent queue or these? Like, because also it seems like there is probably a boost, but then what library do people really use? Like maybe just like the lexical cache is too slow or something?
So we have mutexes in the standard, but not a concurrent queue yet. What can we use in the meantime? So Microsoft ships PPL that has a concurrent queue. Intel ships TBB, which includes PPL, and that those threading building blocks, which has a concurrent queue. And these work on Windows, Linux, and Microsoft and Intel compilers. Almost everybody with a concurrency library has some sort of concurrent queue of some flavor. So use those. There is almost certain to be one of those available on your platform because they're so basic and so necessary. But those would be ones to try. Of course, Anthony Williams' threading library. I don't know offhand if it has one, but I would be surprised if he didn't have something as useful as that.
I think the first one to reach for that sort of cross-platform that has a wide distribution and a lot of documentation would be TBB. That's Intel's threading building blocks.
I think we're done here. So on behalf of the three of us, let me thank you very much for being here.
Yes, thank you.
And I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you very much.